that are allowed to find the global minimum for active contours. So we get one point, starting point, end point, and we find this minimal path. With the two steps we described yesterday, first step is to compute the minimal action, which corresponds to the geodesic descent solving iconal equation, and then making a gradient descent from this endpoint to the start point. So now I mentioned that it was a fast algorithm. It's called fast marshing. So one first thing that I mentioned yesterday, that this fast marshing algorithm, you pass by each grid point only once, which means that since at each iteration you give a final value to one grid point. So relatively to previous algorithms which met a complete sweeping of the image domain many times, so it is one first point that shows that it is faster. But now we can compute the complexity of the algorithm, which is you have, since you have n grid points, in each iteration you have one grid point that is given a value, so you have exactly n iteration. And at each iteration, the computation time is a fixed. You have to solve the equation we saw yesterday, which is always the same computation time, constant time, to at most four neighbors. And what may take more time, time dependent on the data, is the fact that at each iteration you're looking for the value that the smallest value among all trial points, and this smallest value, it means that you have at each iteration when you compute the new trial point, you have to put them in good to sort them according to their value, and this to find the position of one point in a list will be computed in log of the number of points. So in the worst case, the number of trial points is of the same order of the number of grid points, which is n, and so the complexity of this fast marshing, it is at most n log n, which makes it very fast. But this is one first thing. Another thing I wish to mention is we saw yesterday the... So in fact, what you saw yesterday, the scheme we solved using fast marshing, in fact, it can be seen that it is equivalent to another way of seeing it, which was introduced by Tsitsikas. In fact, you have two authors who introduced this method. What is called the fast marshing was introduced by Tsitsikas, and the other idea, which is in fact equivalent, it was introduced by Tsitsikas in at the same time. So the idea, so this was about 95, 96, I don't know, both of them. Okay, so the idea is in fact, if you read the paper by Tsitsikas, you don't find what I show here, but it is decoding the paper. You can understand the idea is the same. It means that when you wish to find the value solving the minimal path equation, integral of p. So you're looking e of c equal integral of p of c s ds. When you try to solve this minimization, you think that at each point, you say that the so you have a starting point p0, which is here. And when you explore one grid point, you what you say is that the minimal path, I mean a minimal path joining p0 and p here, will have to pass by the square formed by the four neighbors. So the four neighbors that we considered in the fast matching algorithm, when you have ij here, you have I plus 1, j, I minus 1, j, I j plus 1, I j minus 1. These four neighbors form a square. And the idea underneath the cyclist method is to say that the minimal path between P0 and P has to cross one of the sides of this square. And so when it crosses this, it means that the minimal path between this and this is equal to the minimal path between starting point and this point, I mean the crossing point here, and this small part of the path. And so it is a little similar to something else we saw yesterday, that the energy here at P, so the integral between P0 and P, is equal to integral to P0 to, to P tilde, say, integral from P tilde to P, where P tilde is this one. And what happens is that this here is the whole energy, and this whole energy that you try to minimize is in fact equal to this integral to from P0 to P tilde. It is on this, and this is estimated from the two values of the neighbors considered here, which means that you assume that you know here what we called U. Let's say I j plus 1 and U I plus 1 j, and you say we're looking for U I g. So what you say is U I g is equal to an average, I mean the barycenter center between these two values, which means you have u I g plus 1 times lambda plus 1 minus lambda u I plus 1 g, where lambda is the location of the point on this segment between 0 and 1, plus the energy of this part of the segment, this part of the path. So this part of the path is estimated as taking a straight line and assuming here that this is a constant, P is constant here, so you have P ij times this distance, which is so if you have lambda here between 0 and 1, it will be let's see here, for example. So here you have lambda, and here you have 1 minus lambda. So it is time this length here, and this length is square root of lambda square plus 1 minus lambda square. So here you have a formula, and which can be written for lambda between 0 and 1. And what you say is that you take the minimum value for lambda between 0 and 1 of this expression. So when you take the minimum value of this expression for lambda between 0 and 1, what you find after some calculus is in fact is the same as the formula we obtained by the fast marching. But but in fact you have to take the minimum over the four sides of the square. In fact, what you say is that the path has to pass that one of the sides, but you don't know which side, which means that you minimize for each of the triangles here, you have this formula minimum of a lambda, and you do it for each of the four rectangles, of the four triangles. Yes. No, in fact, this is something that will come soon. But the main thing on this kind of method is that these are continuous methods. I mean, these are discrete approximation of a continuous definition. So here, the geodesic path is a continuous path that does not pass by grid points. It is between grid points, and this is in fact. I will explain in a moment. I think this is what will differentiate this fast marching method from the well-known Dijkstra method that you may have found some similarity. So I will come back to your question in a few slides. So this is some extra remarks relatively to what we saw yesterday. So now, from the application point of view, once you have found the minimal path between two points, in fact, the main computation is solving the iconal equation from the starting point. And in fact, if in this image you give this starting point, then you can give many endpoints. So here, 1, 2, 3, 4 endpoints. And the extra computation is very small because it is only the gradient descent does not take much time relatively to the fast marching. So here, if you need to find many paths from the same starting point, you have almost no extra time to compute it. So you give the starting point, compute the minimal action, then you get all these paths at the same time. So here's a second example, here with vessels. You give a starting point, and you give end points here, and you have all these paths that are found, and that it takes only one path of the fast marching. Okay, so that was very soon. So this is we had the question: is it a discrete or a continuous method? In fact, so what I said, this is the discrete approximation of a continuous model, and this makes a difference with what is well known, at least by computer scientists, the Dijkstra algorithm, which finds the minimal energy on a graph. Which means that we saw graph yesterday. So if you have a graph, so which is a set of points, and you have a value. And you're looking for the minimal path between starting grid point P0 and end point P1. And you define the cost to go from a point to another point as along a path, which is a set of connecting points on the graph, where at each point you have a weight, which may be W, depending on the node. And so you have the a discrete cost, which will be the sum of the W along this considered path. It can be one or the other, but I mean, this leads to different consideration, but mainly this it can be the same. I mean, you know, what concerns us is almost the same thing, because what we consider is a path. So when you have a path, you consider either the sum of this of the cost of their nodes, or the sum of the cost of the I don't find the name. Edges. Okay. So in this case, what happens? The Dijkstra method is very similar to the fast marching method in the fact that from P0 you consider a kind of propagation method where you, in fact, the basic idea of the Dijkstra method is to say that the minimal cost at P1 will have to pass by one of its neighbors. I mean, a minimal cost path will have to pass by one of the neighbors. So the minimal cost will be the minimum of the minimal cost at each of the neighbors plus the cost of the extra edge. And this is this formula is written recursively, so that the value here will be the minimum of these three values plus the edge, but the value here will itself be the values of its own neighbors plus the extra edge, etc. And so you have a kind of propagation which goes on till it reaches this node for which you know that the cost is zero. So this cost you have a zero, this point you have a zero cost, and so this cost is propagated then on the whole graph, and then you find the minimal cost. So when you have an image, you can consider the grid graph formed by the grid points of the pixels of the image, and at each grid point you give what we have called the potential Pij, will be the weight. And so you can consider the Dijkstra algorithm as a graph minimization of a cost of a path on a graph. And applying Dijkstra will lead to a very similar algorithm to the fast marching, in the fact that at each point you'll have the mainly the minimum of this one of the four neighbors plus the edge, which means that the Dijkstra algorithm here will correspond to the minimum according to the four edges of Pij. It will be the potential here plus the I mean, it will be U, let's say, UN is N is the neighbor plus PN, where PN is the neighbor. So you minimize this over the four neighbors. So this is the Dijkstra algorithm, which means that you have exactly the same, you can give exactly the same definition as we saw with the fast marching yesterday of a life point, trial point, etc. And but the fact is that what you're looking for in this Dijkstra formulation is a discrete path. So the path passes by the grid point. So the difference can be seen on this simple example where you consider the potential P equals to 1. And then the minimal path, the minimal cost between this point and this point, using the Dijkstra formulation, you can see that this any path that does not go back, on, which means that it always goes right and up, any such path will have exactly the same length, the same cost, which will be here, in fact, the cost is 1 everywhere, so the cost corresponds to the length of the path, which will be 5 times, 5 here, plus 5 here. So any path going right and up will have the same cost, which will be 5 plus 5. Which means that if you consider the any points on the image domain, the value of the distance will be the city block distance or L1 distance, so it will be this plus this, which means that the level set of the result of the Dijkstra algorithm will be such that these are squares, so the distance at any point here will be this plus this, so it corresponds to this square. And this will be the same result, whatever the resolution you consider on the domain. Which means that here, if you reduce the size of the grid the pixels by 2, the Dijkstra result will give exactly the same result, because it will all give this length plus this length. So it doesn't matter if you reduce, if here you have 5 pixels or you have 500 pixels, it will not, doesn't change anything. You'll always find the same result. While in the fast meshing method, what you solve is the continuous problem. I mean, looking for to solve the iconal equation. And if you increase the resolution, you will converge to the exact solution. And so in this case, where p equals 1, you find the Euclidean distance. So the level sets are circles. So when you make the resolution tend to 0, the level set will give you perfect circles. So you see the main difference between the idea in Dijkstra method on a graph. When you consider a graph, when you consider the minimization of the path that goes on grid points, and the fast meshing algorithm, which consider the continuous path that links the points. Okay. So in fact, okay. So now we're going to see a few improvements of on the applicative point of view. Of this approach. So in order to make less computation, so the fact is that we saw that you need to compute from the starting point, you compute the fast meshing of the whole domain to solve the iconal equation, and then you make a gradient descent from the endpoint. But from what you said, by construction, the fast meshing algorithm makes the computation by increasing values of U, which means that when you make a gradient descent on this point P1, by definition, you'll make a descent in values of U. So you'll pass by points only, or by points that have a value of U less than this point. Which means that the fast meshing does not need to be computed over the whole domain. In fact, you need to compute the fast meshing only till the front propagation reaches the endpoint. So you see here, from this point, the front propagation of the fast meshing, till it reaches the endpoint here. So when it reaches this point, you can stop the fast meshing. You have all the information needed to find minimal path, since by gradient descent, you'll all the points that have a value less than the endpoint have been computed. So this means that you can reduce the computation, so this is a simple example here. Where you see here the propagation. So I think you understand the idea. Is that the fact that you reduce the computation, but now you can also do that from the 2 points simultaneously, which means that here, when you, the 2 points here are far from the one to the other, and in fact, computing this partial front propagation will give anyway most of the image grid points. So what we can propose as well is to say that you make a propagation simultaneously from both points. So you can propagate both from the starting point and the end point, and then you stop the fast marching algorithm when the two fronts here meet. So when these two fronts meet, which means that you have to keep track of each front, which means that at the same time you propagate the fast marching, you propagate the values of U. You also propagate the values of an index, which says from where you come. Which means that here, when you leave, you may have an index L equals 0 for P0 and L of P1 equals 1. And then whenever you compute the value at a point here, it will be dependent on, it will correspond to one of the four triangles here. And so the value of L here at the new point will be the common value of L as the two neighbors. So now if the 2 points here have different values for L, it means that the two fronts have met. I mean, the first time that this situation is that the point has the two neighbors which have different values of index, it means that these points, for example, comes from P0, and this point comes from P1, and so this point will correspond to the time when the two fronts meet, and you will stop at this point. So there are ways to find precisely where is the meeting point of the front. So once you have found this situation, you stop the front propagation, and from this meeting point, you make gradient descent on both fronts, which means that you consider the gradient descent on, first you consider only the point for which L equals 0, and you make the gradient descent, and then the point from which L equals 1, and you make the gradient descent. So you'll have the two paths of the path. So you'll have this path and this path. And in fact, adding these two paths correspond to the minimal path between this point and this point. It means, in fact, the first point where the two fronts meet has to be on the minimal path, and it is exactly the halfway in energy, which means the energy from P0 to this meeting point is the same as the energy from P1 to this point. So it is half of the energy from P0 to P1. Okay, so this means that in fact, this means that these two, when you give 2 points, you can reduce again the computation of the minimal action. Okay. Now you can also extend, I mean, the definition we gave. In fact, we gave a definition where you have only one starting point. But in fact, you can extend everything we said so far to a set of starting points. So we can assume that your starting point is replaced by your starting set S, and what we said before is exactly the same. So you look for the path at each point P of the image domain. You'll define US of P as being the minimum value of the energy among all paths that start on a point of S and end at P. So, in fact, if you consider this definition, in fact, it is exactly the same thing as considering the minimum value of all the UP0 for each point of the starting set. So it says this definition is the same as this definition, which consider for each point in this starting set, you consider, for example, you have many points. For each point, you consider UP, the minimal action from this starting point, and then you consider the minimum value of all this. So this is the same. And in fact, what we can see is that the US that has been defined like this satisfies the iconal equation gradient US equal P with boundary condition US equals 0 on all starting points, on all the starting sets. So this comes from the fact that this for each point in the starting set S, you can define the set of points X such that P0 is smaller than all the other UQ for all other points. So this, yes?
Yeah. The?
Why? You know, this by definition, it means that the energy between P0 and P0 is zero. The minimal path between for any point on the starting set, the energy is zero by definition. Okay, so here this definition corresponds to a Voronoi partition of the image domain, where each zone here in each in free end zone here corresponds to the set of points that are closer in energy to P0 than all the other starting points. So this is like this. So if you have many starting points, so here, I mean, this is a general definition. I mean, the Voronoi partition is a very general method. So it's a definition. So here, what you say that this zone here corresponds, here it is very simple distance for the Euclidean distance. The set of points for which are closer to this point than to the others is exactly the triangle here obtained by the mediatrix. You know what is a mediatrix? Okay, so each of these is a mediatrix between this point and one of the others. Okay, so what I say here is that if you consider this Voronoi partition, what you can see is that by definition, on each of these zones, the US equals UP0. I mean, for all points on the for all points in this zone here, since you are closer to P0 than to the others, it means that the US will be exactly UP0 inside this triangle. The same reason, in this zone, US will be equal to U at this point. And in this zone, US will be U at this point. So it means that US equals at each point, the US is the U of the corresponding zone. So since you have a partition of the domain in this inference zone, you can everywhere write US as U something, U on one of the starting points. And since each of these satisfies the iconal equation, US also satisfies the iconal equation. So this is true only on the interior of the zone. I mean, on the boundary here, it means that the boundaries of the zone, it means the points where the minimum here is reached at at least two points. And this means that, in fact, at these points, you U is not differentiable on these edges. So, but inside everywhere else, you have U satisfying the Eichhorn equation. So basically, if you give the starting set S, you can apply the fast smashing algorithm exactly the same way we saw before. So you'll have front propagation from each of the starting points simultaneously. And as I said, you can define index of each starting point and propagate these in indexes as well. And and this way you'll get the you'll get the minimal geodesic distance to the closest point in the set. So this is something that we'll use later on. So another variation on this minimal path is to consider, instead of giving a starting point and an endpoint to find the minimal path, we can consider, in fact this is motivated by some medical application, where we'll see later on a 3D image where we have a complex structure, it is easier to give just one starting point because we don't know well where is an endpoint, the second endpoint, it's difficult to find it. So what you can say is that you give just a starting point and you wish to explore the structure for a given length. So what you consider is that you give the starting point and then you make a fast smashing propagation till you reach a point for which the length is given. So for this, it means that you have to compute the length of the minimal path. So what it means that so you compute, you give P0, and you give, so you have this front propagation obtained by the fast marching, and at a given step in the fast marching, you can consider all points that are located on the front. For each point here, you can consider the minimal path. And consider the length of the minimal path. So if you consider this, you can stop the algorithm whenever the length of the minimal path has reached a given length. So assume that in the application here, we say that you give a starting point and you wish to explore the structure for a length of 100 pixels, the unit of length. Then you say that you'll make the fast smashing propagation and you will stop it, and the end point will be the first point to reach this 100 length. So now, it doesn't mean that you have to compute the length of the whole, all the minimal paths that appear in the front propagation. And it even more, you don't have to compute the paths themselves. In fact, what you can do is to make an algorithmic trick that at the same time you propagate the front to compute the geodesic distance, you can also compute the Euclidean length of the path, which means that here, using this formulation by Stitlikly, you can say that here we said that the minimal action here is equal to the minimal action to one point on this side plus this small part. And so we say that the length, at the same time that you make this computation here, we can define Lij is the length of the minimal path between Pij and P0. And this length here is equal, exactly with the same formula. Assume that in this formula you found lambda min, which reaches the minimum value here. Then you'll consider the length of the path, will be obtained as lambda min Lij plus 1 minus lambda min Li plus 1j plus square root of lambda min square plus 1 minus lambda min square. So if you consider this formula, it means that the value, the length of the minimal path here is estimated as being the length of the path, this part of the path, which is estimated by linear interpolation between L, the length here and the length here, plus this small part here, which the length of this is lambda square plus 1 minus lambda square, and you take the square root. So you have this simple formula that can be included in the fast marching algorithm, and which means that whenever Lij, so at the beginning L of P0 equals 0, and whenever Lij reaches the given length, for example 100 pixel units, then you stop the propagation, you stop the fast marching, and you consider this first point to reach the length as being the end point. And so this is what you see here. You have the fast marching, and you have here the computation of the length of the minimal path. And when you reach this length, you stop and you take this point, you make gradient descent. So this is something that can be very useful to just give a starting point and not giving the end point. And this will, in fact, also be used later on. Okay. In fact, this maybe I'll skip. And this as well, I should skip it. Okay. So now we'll pass to extension of this minimal path to 3D images. So far we've dealt with 2D images. And so we gave a starting point or a set of starting points and an end point, and you find a path. So this allowed us to find segmentation, which means that we were able to find the contour of an object, or to find tubular structure like vessels. So when you extend this approach to 3D, you have two ways to extend the problem to 3D. I mean, before extending the method, the problem we solve, there are two ways to extend it to 3D. So the problem, I said you have segmentation, and we had tubular structure. So in 2D, these are the same, you have a curve. In 3D, when you pass in a 3D image, the segmentation is no more a curve. When you wish to make the segmentation of an object in a 3D image, like a medical image, you wish to find the boundary of an organ, for example, of the heart, you have a surface. While when you extend to 3D the problem of finding tubular structure like vessels, in 3D the tubular structure is still a curve. So this is a curve. So when you extend the problem, when you think the method of the geodetic method we've presented so far, when you extend it to a 3D image, it will lead to a 3D geodetic path, which means a curve, a 3D curve. So the natural extension to 3D of all this is finding a 3D geodetic path, which means a curve. So it will adapt to solve the problem of finding a tubular structure in a 3D image. In order to extend the geodetic path to this problem of segmentation of a surface, we'll see later on, then we can also propose some extension of this geodesic method to find a kind of minimal surface in a 3D image. But for the moment, what we consider is the natural extension of geodesic path in a 2D image. It will be a geodesic path in a 3D image, which means a curve joining two points. So when you have defined it like this, you have exactly the same formulation, which means that you give a starting point P0 and endpoint P1. You define the minimal action as being the geodesic distance between the starting point P0 and the point P in the image. You see that U satisfies the iconal equation in 3D domain with boundary condition U equals 0 at P0, which is the starting point. And you solve this using the fast marching algorithm, where the numerical scheme in 3D is like this, where instead of having four neighbors, you have one above and one below, which makes six neighbors. And so you have this natural extension of the numerical scheme. And the fast marching is exactly the same thing. At each iteration, you take the smallest value in the trial point, and you update the solution of this at each of the six neighbors. Yes?
Is there any time step on the right-hand side of the equation? Is
this one? No. There's no time step. This is the numerical scheme to solve this. What I say is that in the fast marching you don't have any time step. It was in the first method to solve this, you had an evolution equation for U where you had a time step. But in the fast marching, you directly solve this at each point, but by ordering the points. Okay, so basically everything we said is the same in 3D, except that the front propagation, the front which correspond to the level set of U, are now surfaces. So, for example, what we said, with a constant potential here we had circles. For a constant potential we have spheres. I mean, the level set, the points that are the same geodesic distance to the starting point, if the potential is 1, it is the same as Euclidean distance, so you have sphere. So you can see an illustration here on a simple example of a spiral potential, which means in 2D it corresponds to this. So you have a potential which is small everywhere, which is dark, except on a spiral which is high. The potential is very high on this spiral, which means that if you start from the center here, the fast marching will propagate inside the spiral like this, and the minimal path between the starting point and end point here will go inside the spiral. I mean, the white area here correspond to obstacles. I mean, high values of the potential correspond as obstacles. So if you do that in 3D, so with this 3D cylinder with a spiral shape here, then this acts as an obstacle, and the 3D propagation from the start point here, the propagation will go at the same time inside the spiral and also in the vertical direction, which will give this minimal path in 3D. So you have starting points here at the center and above, and you have the endpoint as outside and below, and you have this path which is a kind of helix which goes into the spiral. So this is just to illustrate this 3D geodesic path according to the potential. Okay. Now in 3D, as I said, the application will be to find tubular structure, like here you see three cross section of the 3D image of CT of the colon or the trachea, and so you'll have a 3D path going in these structures. Now, something more funny is that this 3D fast meshing can be applied as well to a different kind of problem, which we saw for the 2D fast meshing that this was equivalent to find, we saw the example of the finding the shortest path between the 2 points with obstacle, or going to point A to point B, minimizing the time you need to go there. And the same kind of problem you can consider problems in navigation and robotics, which can, like here it is example from Sitian, which describe this example as you wish to move a piano from this place to this place in a small apartment, and so you have to move in the white area, you cannot move through the walls. And so you're looking for the optimal path, which means that the shortest path inside your apartment to move the piano. So in fact, this corresponds to finding a geodesic path inside the white area. But now, what we see is that this can be explained. Defined as a minimal path in a 3D space. In fact, assume for the moment that what you are looking for is to move a point, I mean, object which is punctual, I mean, which is only one point. So if you're looking for to move 1 point from here to here, and you have this walls, then to go from here to here, the minimal path will be exactly the geodesic path inside the white area, which corresponds here to the shortest path inside the white area between the starting point and the end point. So this is a 2D geodesic path. Now, assume that instead of having a punctual point, you have a sphere, a disk here. So here you wish to move a small disk. So the difference is that instead of moving a point, you move something which is thick. So now, in order to solve the problem, you will have to, in fact, you still have a geodesic path in a 2D domain, but what you say is that the potential here the potential can be described as being one where it is white and infinity where it is gray, or here a very large value when it is gray. So this was the first problem. Now, if your point is thick, what you say is that the potential, instead of taking one when it is white and infinity when it is gray, what you say is that you compute the potential to be one when the whole disk can be included in the white area, and you put infinity whenever the disk touches the gray area, which means that in fact the potential P will be the maximum value. I mean, assume that you have P. P is the original potential, which is 1 for white. And when I write infinity, it can be, for example, 1 million when for gray. Now, what you define for a small disk here, it will be, for example, if you have radius r, you define pr equals min equal max of p of x for x in pr of y equals max of p of x for x in br of y, which means that you consider the value at point y is the maximum value of the potential in this ball of radius r. So whenever a point is gray, the potential will be infinity, so the whole potential Pr will be infinity. So this formula corresponds to make dilatation of the obstacle by radius r. Okay. So, but it still is a problem of finding a geodesic in a 2D space. So this was the first step. Now assume that you don't have a sphere, but you have a piano. So you have a piano like this. So what you could do first is to say that I wish to move my piano from here to here. So if you wish to, you have your object over here, and you define a potential P. PO equals, you can follow the same definition, max for x in y plus rho of P of x. So the value of the potential on this point will be infinity whenever the piano touches the wall. So this potential will give you the place where you can put your piano. So now if you consider this potential and a minimal path according to this potential, this will give you a geodesic path between this and this, but considering this object O is always the same. So it means that it does not rotate. So in this case, if you make this dilation by this object, you'll have something like this, and you'll have something like this. So the piano will not be able to move from this area here. So it is a problem here. So if you remain in 2D, you cannot solve the problem. So what you can do here is to add a third dimension. You can add a third dimension, and this third dimension is the orientation of your piano. So now you have a third dimension theta, which corresponds to the orientation. For example, here you correspond to theta equals 0, and here theta equals p over 2. What you define now is p o of y and theta equals max for x in y plus o theta of p of x, where o theta or theta is the object O rotated by angle theta. So which means that p of y, p o of y and 0 is exactly what we define here, which means that if you remain with an angle 0, you cannot move. But now if you consider the same thing with angle pi over 2, the obstacle which is here will be dilated in the other direction. It will be like this, and this one will be dilated in this direction. So when you have an opening here to pass a piano which is oriented in this direction. So now that you have defined this 3D potential, depending on space and orientation, then you can define a geodesic path between this point x angle 0 and this point, x 0, 0, and this point x 1, 0. So you have two points in the 3D domain, and you're looking for a geodesic path, which means a path which will stay inside the white area defined by this definition, which means that here the theta will go out of theta equals zero, and you will be able to pass by here and go around. And this gives you. So this is an example of problem where you have a 3D geodesic path, which can be solved using a 3D fast marching algorithm, and you have here the minimal path that is shown between these two points. So you have similar examples here or here. Okay. So you can have other kind of problems where the size of the object may change. So you may add another dimension in the which is the size. So you may have a problem in four dimensions, for example, where the two dimensions are the location, one dimension is the orientation, and one dimension is the size. And then you're looking for a path between two points in this four-dimensional space, and which will correspond to such problem. So this is another example for 3D fast marching. So now yet another example or of 3D geodesic path. So this is a little similar to what we just saw. You have a 2D problem. You're looking for a 2D structure in a 2D image, which is a vessel, and you increase the dimension of the space by one dimension, one artificial dimension, which here will be the size, the radius. So what is shown here is that when you're looking for a vessel in a 2D image, in fact, what we've done so far using minimal paths for a vessel, you give a starting point and an end point, and you find a path going along the vessel. There are different ways to find a path that is centered inside the vessels, and there are different reasons why it is useful to have a centered path. We'll come back to this later on. But assume that it is useful to have the centered path. What we can do is model the vessel shape as being defined by a central axis plus a thickness, local radius of the vessel, which means that the vessel here, the boundary of the vessel is in red, and what you can describe this vessel as being a central path here, so which is a path in 2D, plus at each point a radius, which corresponds to the larger radius that can be put inside the vessel. So now this central axis plus radius correspond to a path in 3D. Here a point in 3D corresponds to X, Y, R. A point here in 3D corresponds to a circle of center X, Y, and radius R. And a path in 3D here corresponds to a set of points X, Y, R, which is exactly what we said here. It describes a central axis plus thickness of the vessel. So here the application will be to vessels, but it can be also to other different things. But what we see here is that we have a definition which is finding a minimal path in a 3D space, where now you have to design a potential P in this 3D space. The same way that here, in the previous example, we designed a potential in the 3D space X, Y plus orientation. Here we have to design a potential in the space X, Y plus radius, in a way that the minimal path, the corresponding into this space, will locate exactly at the center of the vessel structure, and the boundary of the vessel will correspond to the envelope of these circles. So there are different ways to do that, but I can give some idea for one approach, is to say that you have, assume that you have a vessel like this, and assume, for example, that it, the vessel is black, and here it is white. Of course, in the general case, it will not be black and white, because if it was so, you would not have any problem. But it is assumed to be close to black and close to white, but it can vary. So now what you can do is consider at any point X, Y, and R, you can consider the variation of the average value of the Gwell level inside this disk centered at XY and radius R, and the disk centered at XY and radius 2R. So now what happens if you are in the background, the difference between R and 2R is close to zero. I mean, the average in the small circle and the large circle is almost the same, so you'll have a small value. Now, if you are on the boundary here, for example, the average here and here is almost the same. If you are inside, the average here is black, while the average here has a little part of black, a little part of white. So the difference between the two will be important. And it will be the most important when the point is exactly here, with the radius exactly, the radius of the vessel. So when you are when the point is in the central axis and the radius is the radius of the vessel, it will give exactly the maximal difference between the two averages. So this is an indicator that can be used to define a potential in a way that the minimal geodesic path according to that potential will locate exactly when where the central axis will correspond to the central axis of the vessel. So it is illustrated here on this example, where you have a starting point here and end point here, and you see that the vessel here is large and here it is thinner. And you see that using the 3D geodesic path here, you get the central axis which follows the vessels, and here the envelope of the circles which gives you the width, the thickness of the vessel, which is here thick and here thin. So, So this is one example. So this is a second example where you have. I didn't stop. So should we stop now? Or?
XY rotation.
Okay, so so we saw extension of geodesic path to 3D, and now we see extension to finding a geodesic path on a surface. And we'll see some application to remeshing of a surface. So which means that you can assume that you have, so instead of being in a 2D or 3D space, what you assume is that you have a grid, you have a mesh of a surface in a 3D domain. So what you assume that you have a mesh, and on this mesh you can define the same problem. Given a starting point and an end point, you wish to find a geodesic path while you stay on the surface. So this can be a classical geodesic on a surface if you consider the potential one. I mean, you consider the real length of the path traced on the surface, or you can also consider weighted distance and assume that at each grid point you have a value of potential P which may vary. So in fact it is a little more complicated than what we did before, but it can be extended. I mean, everything is almost the same, that you solve the iconal equation on the surface domain, but the fact is that here, instead of having a regular grid, you have a mesh where you have triangles, and so the fast meshing has to be adapted. So I will not go into details, but the fact is that when you are a point, the equivalent of this triticlist idea here will correspond to that when you have you are a mesh for a surface. Each point will have a set of neighbors, which are 3D neighbors. It's not planar, and so you will have a set of triangles, and you can apply exactly the same idea as we said here, that you can have an estimate at this point by the fact that the minimal path between the starting point P0 and this point has to pass through one of the sides. These triangles, for each of these triangles, so you can define an equivalent of this fast meshing method. I mean, where the scheme is a little different, and also you may have problems if you have obtuse angles. So there are ways to solve this kind of thing, and I will not enter into details. But basically, the fact that you have to know is that it can be solved, and given a starting point, you can here have what we see here is the colors correspond to the level set of the geodesic distance to this point, and you, given any point, you can make a gradient descent on the surface, and according to the geodesic distance, and you find the geodesic path. So here you have another one, so starting point here, and end point here, and you have a path here. In fact, you have two ways of seeing it. I mean, you can see it directly on triangles, or also you can project it on a planar way and see it as a Riemannian metric. You have different ways. So what's the problem? I mean, the fact that when you give a starting point, you propagate. No, because you pass by any grid point only once, so you cannot. Yeah, in fact, because no, you have to reach all the points because you at each iteration you update one grid point, so you have to go on. I'm not sure you of your question. Okay. So here are examples of geodesics on surface, and as a rabbit, you'll see it again. So here is a mesh of the hand. So you give one starting point, and you have this propagation of the front. And this is what I already said, in fact. And here's the rabbit again. Okay. So when you give a starting point, you see here that you have kind of circles, but which are deformed by the shape of the mesh. And so here you have a geodesic, and what you this is another starting point. So you have different geodesics. But one interesting thing here is that if you use, instead of one starting point, you use many starting points, as we said earlier, then the geodesic you'll find is the geodesic to the closest point. So here you give two starting points, here and here. So you have here the geodesic distance to these two points correspond to the minimal geodesic distance, either to this one or to this one. So if you take a point on the right side, the geodesic will lead to this point. If you take a point on the left side, the geodesic will lead to this point. So in any case, when you make the gradient descent, you'll find the geodesic to the closest point, to the closest starting point between these two. Yeah, there is a ridge, yes. So you have to be on one side of the ridge. I mean, you have to choose your side, but basically you can say that you have two geodesics, or you can say that you are you have one. But if you are exactly on the ridge, I mean, you have to consider a gradient descent, and the first point which be chosen as a descent will give the direction, either on right or left. Okay, so now what you see here is if you consider a lot of starting points all around, then you can get this kind of picture, which looks funny, but you'll see what we use it for in a moment. So this set of points will lead to Voronoi partition of the surface. And here you get the minimal geodesic distance everywhere. Okay, so now this geodesic distance on the surface can be used. In fact, we introduced a method to give a new mesh, a regular mesh, from an initial mesh. So assume everywhere we assume that we have an initial mesh where we compute the fast marshing, and from this mesh what we can do is to start. What we propose here is kind of furthest point sampling, which is called furthest point sampling, which means that you give a starting point. So here again it is a very simple example to illustrate what happens, but it can be done with any kind of surface. So here you assume the first surface is a small square. I mean, it's just to understand well what happens. So this square, in fact, is a surface. You assume that you have a mesh on this surface, and you start by this point, or you could have started by any point on the surface, and you compute the geodesic distance, the fast marching. So in this case, the geodesic distance corresponds to the Euclidean distance because you are planar. So you have here circles. So now the idea is to consider now the point on the surface which is the furthest to the starting point. So this the point is this one. Once you have chosen this furthest point, you now compute the geodesic distance to both this point and this point, which means that you add this point to the set of starting points. So it means that you have the geodesic distance to this point and this point. It looks like this. So you have in two zones which are delimited by the diagonal here, where you have on both sides you have the Euclidean distance to this point and this point. In fact, in general, it is the geodesic distance. So now remark that here you don't have to compute everything again. You can just update from what you had here. You make a fast marching from the new points that you added till you reach points that are smaller than what you are computing, which means that here you make a propagation, and whenever you meet a point that the previous result was smaller than the new result, then you stop the propagation locally, which means that here you have to compute only the updated part of the domain. So here half of the domain. But when you go on this process, what happens is that you consider here the furthest point again. So here you have two points that are the furthest points. So you choose one of these, and you update the geodesic distance. So now we have three starting points, and between this and this, you have updated only on this small part, which is 1/4 of the domain. So now you're going to iterate this process and adding points each time you add the furthest point. So now the furthest point is this one, and you update. So it will change here, and you go on the next furthest point is this one, and you go on to update, and you find this geodesic distance map. So whenever you add points, I mean, now you're going to add a lot of points, but the further you are in the iteration, the smaller will be the region of the domain to update, which means that globally the computation time is not so large because each time you make a fast marching on a smaller and smaller region. So the algorithm, in fact, this is what I explained. So at the beginning you have only one point for which you compute the u1 distance to x1, and you consider xn plus 1 being the maximum value of un, and you consider sn plus 1, you add xn plus 1 to s, and un plus 1 is the minimum of un and xn plus 1. So this you know already, and this is what you make the update. And now you stop whenever you can stop whenever with different criteria. One criterion would be to say you wish to cover completely the domain with geodesic distance smaller than delta, for example. Okay. And so this cool algorithm, once you have ended, it is order n log n square. Log n square is because you so it is not I mean, each fast marching is odd of n log n, but since you each time you have a fast marching on a smaller and smaller domain, it is the larger bound on the algorithm is n log n square. So it is still very fast. And what happens is, for example, the moment I haven't said what it is used for. So now that you have understood the algorithm, we're going to see how it can be used. So now you've seen the points added. So if you add a large number of points, the point will have this property of being, since each time you add the new point as being the furthest point to all the others, the new points will be in the furthest away from all the previous ones, which means that they will have the property to behave like that. They will be uniformly distributed on the domain. And so here you see different steps in the iteration, and you see that whenever you go on this process, you have a set of points that are uniformly distributed on the domain. And each time it is hierarchy, because which means this set of points contain this set of points, which contains this set of points. So it will enable you to define a hierarchical multi-scale representation of the surface, but also of the mesh, because each time you have this set of grid points, set of points that you have defined as starting point, you also have the Voronoi region, which can give you the neighbors. Two points will be considered neighbors if their Voronoi regions have a common boundary, and this will give you a mesh. So here you see the mesh that corresponds to the set of points above. So this corresponds to a Delaunay triangulation. I mean, this is the same idea. But the fact here is that this Delaunay triangulation is obtained by this geodesic distance criterion, which means that at each point, at each step in this iteration, the set of points are uniformly distributed according to geodesic distance, which means that each point has a geodesic distance to the neighbors, which is almost the same. And okay, so here you see what happens on different cases. So here a sphere and a torus, and for each one you can consider the Delaunay triangulation and also the geodesic triangulation, which means that here you have the mesh you have defined. For each point you have some edges to different points, but you have also the corresponding geodesics that link these different points. So these are the geodesics, these are the triangles. And the fact is that when you add points, you iterate the process, it is what I said, you have uniform remeshing, where you have a hierarchy of remeshing. So you have a mesh that can be as more and more it could be used for that, of course. I mean, one thing is that to compute fast marching, to start, you assume that you already have a mesh. But here, what you can get is from a mesh, even if this mesh is a very bad mesh. For example, if you have a mesh that was obtained by a first method that doesn't guarantee that your mesh is regular or your mesh is very nice, you can use this because it is very fast, and you can obtain a uniformly distributed mesh at any scale. And also, the nice thing that this mesh contains this mesh, which contains this mesh. It is a hierarchy. Usually, when you have multi-scale meshes, it is not so you don't have a hierarchy like this in most methods. Okay, so now what is also okay? Okay, so this is a different application. One application of this is can be you can use this to segment a surface in different parts using the Voronoi regions and flatten the surface to draw a texture on it. For example, here you have a mesh of the face. You can here flatten this using these geodesic maps and put a texture on the flattened surface and then get the texture on the initial surface. Okay, so now the most interesting thing here, I mean, this is interesting to have uniformly distributed remeshing, but what is even more interesting is that we can also use the same algorithm and see what happens when instead of having a constant potential, a constant metric on this surface, what happens is you have a metric that can vary. So it means that here you keep the same very simple surface of a square, and you assume that you have a value of p, which is p1 here, p2 here, where p1 is smaller than p2. Then what happens is that if you are going to do exactly the same algorithm, so you start from this point, you make a fast marching, so you have a lower speed here where the potential is larger, and then a higher speed here where the potential is smaller, and you find the furthest point. So by definition, here since the potential is smaller, the distance between two points here will be smaller, while the distance here will be larger. So the furthest point here will be here. And now you update using this point and this point, and the furthest point will be here. So you update, and if you go on this process, what you see is that in this process you have added more points on the right than on the left. So naturally, this algorithm will give you an adaptive remeshing of the surface, where so here it is just a synthetic example where it just will illustrate the purpose. So here you have a mesh of a face, and here using uniform remeshing, the what we saw just before, and here what we get using adaptive remeshing, where you have two values of p, one here and one here. So it's not useful here, but just to illustrate that this process will give you a denser triangulation above than below. So the mesh will be denser here than here, which means that you can define an adaptive remeshing according to what you wish. So now you may wish to have a denser mesh in some regions, depending on your data or depending on your application. So we see here two examples. One example is you assume that you have a mesh of a surface together with a texture. For example, you have the picture of this guy. I think it is former student of Ron Kimmel that you'll see soon. So this is a surface. You have a mesh of a surface together with the picture on the surface, which means on each point of the surface you have a variable value which corresponds to the face. Now what you may wish is to have a remeshing of the surface where the mesh is finer, where you have details of the features on the face, which means when you have the eyes, the nose, the mouth, it corresponds where, in fact, where the gradient of the texture is large. So here, what you see here is a function of the gradient of the texture, which underlines the features of the face. So when it is white here, it means that the gradient is large, the gradient of the texture is large. And so you may wish to have a denser remeshing where it is white here. So you may define on each point of the surface initial mesh, you define a potential which is a function of the gradient of the texture, and then you have a remeshing here, which you see you have more points here, and you have a mesh that is finer where you have more precise details. Okay, so a second example where you may need remeshing which is finer is to make a reconstruction where you have high curvatures. So for example, here you have two objects which have sharp edges. And if you apply to these surfaces a uniform remeshing, this is what you get, where you have a perfect reconstruction, which is here on each face. But of course, where you have sharp edges here, you see that the surface of the triangulation will be very, it will be poorly reconstructed. So if your goal is to have a remeshing with a small number of weak points, but which is as close as possible to the original surface, this will not be very good. So what you can do is to use the adaptive remeshing using a potential which is a function of the curvature. So it means that at each point on the initial mesh, you can have an estimate of the local curvature. And from this estimate, you will define the potential P in a way that the adaptive remeshing will give denser mesh where the curvature is higher. And this is what you see here. In fact, what you see is that you have a perfect reconstruction of the cube or this piece here. And in fact, here and here you have only, you have the same number of grid points, which are about a few hundred points, while in the initial you have a few thousands. So you have reduced the number of points considerably, but you still have a very precise reconstruction of the surface. So it is estimated, there are different ways to estimate the curvature, but basically you at each point you consider in the triangulation, you consider the different neighbors, and you make an estimate of the second derivative. Yes. What is that? Here you are.
There's a flat part over there.
Yes.
So the mesh shouldn't be fine. It should be the curvature zero. So you
should have. No,
it looks denser on the flat part.
No, it is not denser. In fact, what you see is here. Here? What happens? Right? Yeah. Yeah.
Very dense, yet the area is flat. That's what you're
looking at. You're at an angle, though. You're not looking at it from the top.
Are you sure?
Well, yeah. It's the angle that you're looking at it
from. Yeah. Yeah, I think if you would see from above, it will be different. Yeah, okay. Okay. So, to end this session, you will see. Yeah.
The question I had is the edges didn't seem to get a finer mesh.
What?
The edges have a line.
Yeah, in fact, here it is, as I said, it is what happens here is that you see that since you have a very sharp edge here, the new points, which is the furthest point that were added each iteration, were chosen, the algorithm chose to put them on the edge itself. So, but you see that along the edge here, you have a denser number of points. I mean, at the same time, they are exactly on the edge, but also there are a denser number here. Okay, so to end this session, we'll see the detailed movie. So what you see with a huge number of I cannot stop it. Okay. So what you'll see is the illustration of what you just said, but here it is a huge mesh of 100,000 read points. So here you see the fast marching on the surface, and then you will see some minimal tasks. So you see, so now with the furthest point sampling strategy, so first we see the uniform remeshing. So it is what we just explained. So you have one point, and you add one point here, then this point, etc. And so you see what happens when you add iteratively this point. So you get here the remeshing. And so you see how the points are added when.
How you said the third is distance, right?
Yes.
It is possible to retrieve a question, but when you have the four, then why do you choose that corner instead of that corner?
I don't choose. It is the algorithm that chooses.
It's a random choice.
Yeah, I mean it is the first point that that were identified as a minimum.
When you're summing the differences, are you going one up to this?
It doesn't matter, in fact, because this one will be chosen later on. But here it shows. You have a question or? Is it okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So here you see the iteration of the mesh. So you see what happens when you have a very large mesh. So here you see the furthest point added iteratively, and you see also the remeshing, uniform remeshing at different scales. And finally, we see what happens with the adaptive remeshing. So here, you have two parts of the surface which are artificially defined. And you see that the iterative scheme here will add more points on one side, so giving a denser mesh on the left. And it is applied here to the texture.
The texture can be applied to
the
surface.
So you have the surface plus the texture, and you compute the gradient. And so the adaptive remeshing is according to the gradient. So you see that you have a denser mesh where you have a high gradient. And so it gives you a very good reconstruction with few grid points. Okay, so we can stop here.